It's 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. My name's Jacob.
Well, I must be Mercedes then. And we're on Community Radio 3CR with Friday Rave.
And welcome back. It is Friday and you're tuned to Community Radio 3CR with me, Mercedes, and Jacob. And we're joined again in the virtual studio by Clinton Fernandez. If you haven't had a chance to listen back to our Saturday kick-on program that we did over the summer, I definitely recommend that you tune into that on the 3CR website or your favourite podcast client. But Clinton, thanks for joining us again on a Friday Rave.
Thanks for the opportunity, I should say.
And I should point out at this stage that it's actually Friday morning. We're not doing this live. We're pre-recording in the Friday Rave. Geez, it feels like a palliative care centre, but the Friday Rave infirmary, at any rate, up here in northern suburbs of Melbourne, because both of us are a little bit crook. So if you hear coughs and groans, please excuse us. And Clinton, we had absolutely, what's the word, no agenda today except to say talk to you about what's going on. And when we first asked you, and I thought, what are we going to talk about? My thought was, the way the world is moving at the moment, it'd be silly to say we're going to talk about this or that, because anything could have happened in the meantime. But we're in a situation now where the world is talking to a large extent about a war in Iran in terms of access to oil, gas and fertilizer, rather than in terms of any suffering of war and the deaths of people and all the rest of it. Where have we got to with the economics of this war?
Oh, well, the economics of the war started, of course, with the attacks that had a nuclear element to it. And the economics comes in because Iran decided to make other countries feel the same pain that it was feeling, or at least a part of it. It's been under sanctions for maybe 47 years. And the immediate trigger was the International Atomic Energy Agency's statement in June 2025 that it could no longer be certain about highly enriched uranium and Iran's treatment of it. And once the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors was advised, the very next day, Israel attacked Iran. That was the pretext. It might not have been the motive, but it certainly was the pretext, and it provided a justification. So the very next morning, after the International Atomic Energy Agency said it couldn't be certain about the chain of custody as to where Iran's highly enriched uranium was, Israel attacked, and the United States joined in the June 2025 war. But what the Iranian military learned from that was that it was Israel that called for a ceasefire first. In other words, it went to the United States, not publicly, of course, but it went to the United States asking for the war to be brought to an end because its missile defenses were being overwhelmed by Iranian surface-to-surface missiles, that's medium-range ballistic missiles. And so Iran learned that, in fact, it may have a greater pain tolerance than Israel. And so when, on the 28th of February, the United States opened the war, along with Israel, of course, by killing the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, the Iranian military was able to react, and they were able to show a kind of resilience that I don't think any Arab countries, as presently constituted, could have shown. You know, they've lost about 3,000 of their top commanders, their political leadership, and the Iranian state continues to maintain its integrity, continues to fight back, and continues to demonstrate that it has the ability to use its geography in the Strait of Hormuz to act as a kind of a pressure valve on shipping entering or leaving that the waterway through which 20% of the world's petrol, crude oil passes.
Yes.
So that's where it is. Where the actual economics is going to bite is for the whole rest of the year, for this reason. In the planting season, that is in April, is when the planting season begins in much of mainland Southeast Asia. We all depend for our food on basic commodities. This is things like rice, for example. Well, rice is grown in large quantities by Thailand, Vietnam, and the Philippines.
Yes.
And the planting season begins in April. That can't be, that's just a fact of life. It can't, it's nature. And in order for the planting season to work, you need to have fertilizer. Fertilizer is made using natural gas, liquefied natural gas. So as the gas shortage flows into the rest of the world, it flows into the feedstocks that make fertilizers, which then go to the farmers to plant the rice. So what
Yes.
we might be facing is by the time it is harvest season, a few months away from now, after the planting season, there may not be enough rice left for everybody, which may lead to rice prices rising. And we'll see this in growing levels of hunger in the region. And for many countries in our region, this is, I would say, east of the Suez Canal. That's where the oil and gas shortages really are.
Yes.
West of the Suez Canal is sort of for Europe and the United States. The United States currently has a surplus of liquefied natural gas to the point where American domestic liquefied natural gas producers are curtailing their production because they've got too much.
They've got too much gas.
Yeah, but east of the Suez Canal, that is Southeast Asia, mainland and island Southeast Asia, there's too little. And so what you've got then is the prospect of food shortages, very real prospect, although not certain, but it's a very real prospect.
And with
And
the shortages of rice, can I just get in here for a moment and say that this reminds me of about a, I don't know, maybe a dozen years ago with the wheat shortages due to environmental factors, climate factors, which led to the bread riots and the so-called uprisings of the so-called Arab Spring, and
yes.
so all that is possible in the next 18 months.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the food crisis of 2008, 2009 had a climate change element to it. And that climate change element was a factor in what became the Syrian Civil War. It was a factor in what became the Arab Spring.
Yes.
It was also a factor in upheavals in Southeast Asia and China's growing integration after the 2008 global financial crisis. It was China's integration with Latin America to get soybeans and ethanol
Yep.
from Brazil.
Yep.
But also, it began to purchase a lot of land overseas in order to get the rice for its population. But you can't kind of do it later. You have to plant in April. You have to begin the planting season in April. You can't do it in June just when the conflict finishes. And for many of these countries in Southeast Asia, when the food shortage, if it occurs, they aren't going to blame Iran. They might blame the conflict or the United States. But to most people, and I'm not saying this is my view, I think that it's their view based on what I'm reading in the papers in their own countries. They regard the United States as the aggressor.
Yeah, I mean, most people do see the United States as the most dangerous country in the world right now. And Australia's response to this, I mean, one of the things we're doing, Australia is doing, is building a urea plant on the Burrup.
Okay.
To take advantage of, I'm assuming they're there to take advantage of Woodside's gas field off the North West Shelf. How is that going to come on stream in any time? Is that we look at a
I wouldn't be able to tell you the answer to that. I would need to see the what the shareholders are being told because that's the actual information rather than press releases.
Yes.
For an expansion like that, they have to actually tell as part of their shareholding prospectus. This is what we're planning on doing. They have calls with investors. So until we hear from that, where the money actually counts, we shouldn't make our plans based on what a government press release says. But yeah, there's an attempt to get to this because, we export wheat. And our large export markets rely on fertilizers as well. It's not as though we're going to run out of food, but the export market for our wheat is going to be affected. So that's what, another reason why we're doing it.
Yeah, and the Australian government has just announced a $1 billion economic resilience program, specifically for producing and transporting things like fertilizers to farmers. And I guess in Southeast Asia, where, now is when crops are having to go in, is there any program to aid in, or aid is a contentious term in this instance, but about how farmers in Southeast Asia are actually going to get a main source of food.
You can't, no, the fertilizer requires like liquefied natural gas. There are shortages. The prices are going up. So one way that it can be solved is by the governments of those countries themselves, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam, buying more fertilizer on the world market and getting it to their farmers. But what that also means is they have got to cut back on their budgets in some other area or go into debt. There's a finite pool of money for these countries. They have budgets which have a certain limit, and if the more they spend on farmer support, the less they spend on other things. And we saw that during the Asian financial crisis, when, as a result of the economic restructuring, governments were able to, were forced to spend, like Indonesia, for example, had to spend more money on repaying the debt that it had to foreign countries and banks than it spent on public housing, public education, and public health combined, right? And what that led to was an angry population, one that became more religious, because then there was more money for religious schools, which would provide a different type of education. And so it then changes the political temperament in those countries. But on this occasion, I think we're just entering an era of crisis and scarcity around the region.
And do you think, I guess, there is a push, like in terms of those debts, of private companies and venture capital firms buying up debts, and bonds in debts in order to get a stake in equity in the country itself, in order to, I guess, make that country acquiescent?
The way you control a country is through debt. And the fact that a venture capital firm is doing it doesn't make it any different. I mean, the International Monetary Fund used to do that,
It's a
right?
venture capital company.
So here's how the debt should be understood. In a capitalist system, if you take the risk, then you get the reward. But if you take the risk, then you also are responsible for that risk. If you take on a loan, I shouldn't have to pay off your loan, right? That's just normal. But here, what you've got is a country that might take on a loan. It's an authoritarian state, let's say. And let's pick any country. It could be Indonesia under Suharto, for example. It's a dictatorship. It takes on a loan from foreign banks. The banks themselves, the Japanese banks and other banks, when Indonesia doesn't have the money, because the value of the dollar goes up and the loans are denominated in dollars, so they have to pay more, even though they haven't borrowed any more. But when they can't, and they go back, unable to pay the default on the loan, the International Monetary Fund comes in and buys the debt. What they're really doing is they are protecting the banks for their bad loans, and then the Indonesian government under Suharto, the post-Suharto government, has to then spend money on paying off the International Monetary Fund, because the Western banks that have lent the money, they've already had their loans covered by the very same IMF. And so the International Monetary Fund is seen as the credit community's enforcer. It's not actually bailing out Indonesia or Venezuela or anything else. It's actually bailing out the banks that have made the bad loans. And if you want to take Latin America, for example, Mercedes, the classic example right now is Argentina, where the United States, because it has a huge amount of voting rights in the International Monetary Fund, has provided billions of dollars of support to help re-elect the authoritarian leader Javier Milei in Argentina. And so That was done because his economic program was terrible. The country needed the money, and it owed a lot of money to the rest of the world. And so the United States stepped in, directed the IMF to loan it money and prop it up. But what that happens then is that Argentina's sovereignty then becomes subordinated to the IMF, which is controlled by the United States through its voting rights. If it's in hoc to a venture capital firm, well, that venture capital firm is closely connected to the United States government, because if let's say Venezuela defaults, it's got the US government to step in as the bodyguard, as the muscle to make sure that the money does get paid back. So it's actually a way of getting another country's sovereignty in your own grasp.
And this is the thing. A lot of people possibly aren't aware of the International Monetary Fund. Their loans aren't altruistic. Their loans are predicated or dependent on a government changing policy to make it easier to repay the loan. So therefore, they're going to spend more money towards supporting the capitalist industries in their economy. And that money is obviously going to come from more socially beneficent spending, whether we're talking about education, health, housing,
Well,
whatever.
it's a welfare system for the banks that make the bad loans. And I want to emphasize here that in a normal capitalist system, which we are told is the one to fight for and to work for and so on, if you take the risk, you get a reward, but you also are at risk of losing your money. And so when the banks make the bad loans, they don't actually lose the money, because it's the IMF that steps in and covers their loan and then makes the country pay. And here's where the long-term effects come in. And long after this call is finished, this particular interview, a year from now, we'll be discussing the events of the last 12 months, right? If we talk again around Anzac Day next year, here's an example. Among these countries, these are developing countries which have a large rural sector, and they have a lot of poor people who live on the fringes of the major cities in the slum areas. Right. And they do things like push rickshaws, sell telephone char recharge cards, things like that. They receive government support in Indonesia, for example. And I'm going to Indonesia because it's our neighbor. I can talk about Venezuela if you like, but it's our closest neighbor, so we need to be aware of it. There's what's called nine essential commodities. The acronym is SEMBAKO, SEMBAKO. These nine essential commodities are things like kerosene, which you can take in a small container, and then you use it to cook your dinner at night, right? There's fertilizers, there's rice, there's a few other commodities there are nine of them. When the IMF stepped in to bail out the Western banks that had made the bad loans to Indonesia was forced to reduce its subsidies off those nine essential commodities to its own population. And that's the reason for the riots and the food riots and everything else that cascaded on later on, right? Because at the granular level of the individual household, whether it's in the farm or in the slum areas on the outskirts of the cities, and all these developing countries have them, it becomes harder and harder to cook your dinner at night, to have your breakfast in the morning, if you're in the farm, to plant your crops, to get your rice, to get your eggs, veggies, things like that. So the basic ability to live every day gets affected, but it doesn't get affected over a 24-hour period or even a 1 month period. The cascading effects will occur 3 months from now. So the planting season is on now, and the loans and so on are being incurred now, because a lot of developing countries are now heavily indebted. But the effect will be felt around September, October, and into the next year.
And I think also, as we mentioned, climate being a major factor as well. The unknowns of climate catastrophe that are incoming is going to just exacerbate that.
We'll see what happens. I mean, April, we're still in the month of April, and for geological reasons, the month of April is the most difficult, if not impossible, month to make weather forecasts in Australia. Okay, if you look at the Bureau of Meteorology, they have the April unpredictability effect, or words to that, or something, or words along those lines. And for basically, April is always the month in Australia where you can't predict what's going to happen. But it looks like there is a better than even chance of a super El Nino event occurring later this year. Okay. And we'll know this around early to mid-May once the Bureau is able to get past the statistical haze that is the month of April. And so if that's the case, then we're going to have a much hotter than usual summer and a much drier than usual summer in Australia. Now that's going to affect things like our own agriculture, but all of us remember what it was like in December 2019 and Jan 2020 during the major bushfires there. We may have lost, what is it, half a billion of our native animals. And so the risks of that keep increasing the longer this thing goes on.
Now, I just wanted to, in the few minutes we've got left to us, I'm assuming, Mercedes, you can
10 minutes.
clock on the time. What you've been talking about, particularly with the things like the IMF and the debt, this is something we've been talking about for, well, look, it's something politicos and analysts have been talking about since Adam was a boy. But I guess what I'm harking back to some stuff, the things you were saying about the Australian gas exports.
Oh, yes.
And you made the comment that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I'm sort of paraphrasing, where we're corporatizing the profit and socializing the debt, or corporatizing the profit and
Privatizing.
socializing the risk, I guess.
You want me to explain that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's self-evident with what with the get, but
Well, look, it's possible that it's well known to people who listen to this station, but even so, I wonder because of the enormous amount of effort that's been put into blocking information of this sort coming out. So, once again, we're back to capitalism, and who takes the risk should get the reward. What people don't seem to understand is until the 1970s, nobody knew where any of the gas was. Nobody had done any surveys. The gas happens to be located under the sea off the northwest cape of Australia. So about 200 nautical miles off the coast of Broome, all the way from the coastline to 200 nautical miles, 300 nautical miles, or where the gas fields are. But nobody knew where they were. Okay. The Australian taxpayer, the Australian public, through the organization that's today called Geoscience Australia, it used to be called the Bureau of Mineral Resources. It's now called Geoscience Australia. It undertook decades-long exploration surveys to map where the oil and gas were. For example, if they find kelp trapped in the rock, it's a possible predictor that there may be gas trapped there as well. There was survey ships that set off from the coast of Port Melbourne, went a predetermined point off the coastline, turned left and came back. And they did that for about 20 plus years at the cost of millions of dollars. Okay.
It
Norway
started
did
under the Gorton government, didn't it?
it began under Gorton, yeah, December 1970. And so not until okay, so not until 1994, from 1970 to 1994, all of the surveys were undertaken, and even more surveys keep getting done. I mean, it happens all the time with Geoscience Australia. Norway did something very similar because ultimately you've got to know where the gas is. But Norway had a national gas company, a national gas, a state-owned oil company called Equinor, and Equinor was able to get the gas for the Norwegians. There's only about 5.5 million, 6 million Norwegians, but they managed to get $1.3 trillion worth of profits, for their sovereign wealth fund. In other words, their pension fund benefited. By contrast, from 1984 till December 2018, the Northwest Cape provided the Australian taxpayer, including taxes, royalties, and revenues, only about $29 to $30 billion. And so we actually took the risk, worked out where the oil and gas was trapped, and then we just gave that intelligence to the gas companies for nothing or next to nothing. They then went across, drilled, out came the gas. And Norway, and they became wealthy to the point where we are now selling gas to Japan at a price that's cheaper than we are paying. And then Japan then exports billions of dollars worth of our gas to its customers. Now, if capitalism actually worked, then the taxpayer that took the risk and paid the cost of working out where the gas was should get the revenues. That's not what's actually happening. We took the risk, paid for the cost, and then the private sector, this is the few thousand super rich families that happen to control Woodside Petroleum, the Northwest Cape, Shell, etc. These are the ones that then take the profit. And as long as we are willing to accept that, there is no prospect of any change.
And
All we'll
then
be able to do is tinker around the margins.
it goes further than that. In fact, we have former politicians then joining the board of Woodside Petroleum, and then we have the secrets Australia's Secret Services
Yes.
bugging the offices of the Timor government to get us after we've told them where the oil is, where the gas
Yeah.
is. We then interfere with another nation to get the cheapest bottom line price.
Yes.
But I want to ask, is the same thing happening now? I want to make the comparison with what's
Yes.
happening in the military industry at the moment, the military
Okay.
industrial complex. We're socializing the risk in terms of the money we're sending to the United States and Great Britain to help their failing submarine industries, which, I mean, I don't think the United Kingdom is able to have a submarine at sea at the moment, or it might have one now. But we've got reports coming out of the US where we've got submarines that have been about to be scuttled because they've done one thing in the last 10 years, and they've cost $1 billion just to be sitting in dry docks for a decade. And we're sending money over to these organizations, but then it's not like we're going to get a submarine out of it. When that happens, and if they are able to make a submarine, we will then buy that from the company. So again, is the military industrial complex another way that
Yes.
we're socializing the risk and privatizing the profit?
Yeah, look, this ought to be an organizer's dream, actually, because there are so many issues on which it's possible to organize people, provided we don't divide ourselves along questions of personal identity or find ways to fight amongst ourselves. It ought to be an organizer's dream. In fact, the ambition of the current leadership, that's the opposition and the government, is for us to be a better quarry, a better gas well, and a better farm. And for our military to focus on demonstrating our relevance to a higher imperial power's military strategy. And in the absence of a political party that is able to demand economic nationalism rather than racial nationalism or cultural nationalism, in the absence of a coherent force that can demand economic nationalism, the situation will continue. But that is, in fact, the role of organizers.
Yeah, definitely. And I just want to go back just very briefly to Geoscience Australia conducting all of the surveys
Yeah.
about gas fields. Has the same thing happened more recently with critical minerals?
Yes, in 2013, Geoscience Australia published a study called Critical Commodities for a High-Tech World.
Yes.
And that study found that we are extremely rich in all of the critical minerals and rare earths that we need for the high-tech transition, for the renewable energy transition, for all of those things. We could, if we wanted to, set up a national critical commodities company or a national critical minerals company owned by the government, by the Commonwealth. Which will then extract the resources, but then keep them in Australia and require companies that want to manufacture stuff to build it in Australia, right? But at the moment, what we've got is one party that is involved, like the Greens, for example, wants to stop mining or reduce it and stop gas altogether. So they're not able to produce that economic nationalist alternative to demand that gas and minerals be produced in Australia through a national gas-owned company. Some force is going to have to come out and insist that we do that. We could, in fact, get these companies to manufacture some of what they want to manufacture here, and then trained by giving apprenticeships to our own people, our own engineers, our own students, and then build the tech their skills to climb the technological ladder. Okay, in the absence of an economic nationalist perspective, there is no prospect of this happening. But if there is an economic nationalist perspective, even if no political party is currently launching it. If there is such a perspective that's brought on as demand, I think it'll catch on like wildfire. It's just beneath the surface of the Australian public's consciousness.
Clinton, thank you so much for joining us again on a Friday rave, and I think we will definitely have to have a conversation in the near future again.
Thanks for the opportunity, Mercedes and Jacob.